all once again to Nerds on the Rocks episode 148. This week we go old school, super old school, and we talk about the SNES era RPGs. But before we get this, introduce our panel. We have Mr. Trent.
Greetings from Canada.
And we have Dan the Man.
Greetings from just outside Canada.
Where are you located, Dan?
Right now, Vermont.
I was hoping for a street address.
Oh, can't go that far.
We don't have to make it weird.
So yes, this week we're talking about SNES era JRPGs. Right, well, I guess RPGs. I really hate the distinctions between JRPGs and Western RPGs. Whatever. But, I mean, back then, I think everything would have been just classified as a JRPG anyhow. But, reason for this? Mostly because of the recent news from Square Enix and, I guess, is it Sega? No, Konami. With the whole movement of kind of resurrecting, like, old-school RPGs onto the mobile platforms, iOS, Android, and stuff like that, I figured it'd be nice to kind of go back to that, especially being that we're ruining so many people's childhood with these iOS ports, apparently. So, if you haven't been keeping up, I believe by the end of this year, Final Fantasy 1 through 6 will be available for people to purchase on their mobile phone of choice. I want to say it's Konami who does Breath of Fire, or one of those companies, who announced, I think, Breath of Fire 6 for...
Breath of Fire is Capcom.
Okay, Capcom. Breath of Fire 6 was announced, and that kind of hit with a... Well, that was a shitstorm, for lack of a better term, when that was announced that it's coming to smartphones and tablets for people, because, again, they felt they were betrayed by...
Well, I think it's only going to be Japan, regardless. Like, that's the weirdest thing about that situation. Most of the people who feel betrayed, quote-unquote, are Westerners, and they wouldn't even see this game come out in the first place. There's no way that they would... there's no way that they can judge it because there's no way that they would be playing it. You know what I mean? So.
Well, that has never stopped the internet from complaining.
That's very true.
But yes, I mean, that was it. But I really think for a lot of people, the breaking point was Final Fantasy VI, and then Square Enix kind of teasing that they might do a Final Fantasy VII. But that might take a while, especially being that it was one of the games we've been clamoring for a remake for over a decade now. I mean, ever since the PS2, I guess, that game has always been like, we need a remake of this game, we need a remake of this game, and it hasn't happened. And to kind of hear him talk about kind of doing it for the mobile platforms have sent people over the deep end. But we're not here to talk about that. We're actually here to talk about the origins of a lot of these franchises, a lot of these games. SNES is known for a lot of things, but I have to say, I would imagine RPGs are right up there with them. Off the top of my head, stuff in the Final Fantasy series, even though it started on the NES, really kind of took off with the... I mean, technically it took off with the PlayStation, but for the sake of the argument, I think a lot of people kind of got familiar with it with Final Fantasy 2 and 3 here, which also created the super weird numbering system that we had for a few years with that franchise.
Yes. 2 is actually 4, and 3 is actually 6.
So, I mean, I guess you would probably be a better expert on this. I kind of get the renumbering since we didn't get Final Fantasy 2 and 3 here and stuff like that. But why did they skip 5?
5 and 3, like the original 3, were both skipped within this region, partially because 3 wasn't quite up to snuff. And partially because, and when I say up to snuff, I mean in terms of narrative. And partially because they operated on job systems. And the thought of Squaresoft at the time was that the job-based every skill that you get, every stat or bonus increase that you make is based on what you choose to do in battle. So the character progression system there is really sophisticated too. And it's not something that I would say even most people playing RPGs today are very used to. 3, like I said, is kind of light on plot and heavy on a job system. And 5, while having a decent plot, was very heavy on job system, and it doesn't really hold a candle next to 4 or 6, so I think that's why it never hit American audiences.
Well, during that era, I mean, all of these games eventually crossed over to seas.
But it has created a number of confusions based on that weird naming dynamic created.
Yes, because when they made the transition to the space station, they just decided we're just going to number it properly, and it's like, oh, 237, there you go, perfect numbering system.
I'm really, really glad that they, to be honest, like, and I understand the confusion at the time of American audiences, but had they gone 234, then we may not have ever received those Japanese releases with official translations. Like, who knows, right? And now you can essentially buy every single game on a fairly newish format in perfect translation. So it's a good time to like Final Fantasy.
That's debatable, but that's, you know, we're trying to try to keep on subject, on topic
here. old school Final Fantasy. It's a good time to like old school ones. Clarify that, I guess.
Final Fantasy. Yeah, when I say Final Fantasy, I mean it's a good time to be a fan of the overall series as opposed to the more recent games.
Okay, that's what I was.
Really,
that's
really bad time.
Yeah,
to be
that's
a
even
fan
been
of
a good distinction there.
Yes, but I mean, aside from the weird numbering scheme and the missing games, what were your thoughts on Final Fantasy 2 and 3? I'm just going to say this up front, and we've had this discussion when we were determining this podcast for this week. When we were coming up with the idea for this podcast, I noted that I've played a lot of Super Nintendo era RPGs, but I've actually played a lot of them as well. Most of them, actually, I don't think I've finished any of them. And I will be honest, it was back in a time when I was big into like, the rock scene and stuff like that. And as much as people kind of, you know, hate ROMs for one reason or another, my biggest beef with pirating games has always kind of been, like, you don't appreciate anything when you get it for free, so you tend not to bother, you don't have to invest anything because you're not invested money into it, so it's like, whatever. So a part of me was like, if I ever hit a patch where I got bored, I didn't want to grind, I was just like, I'm done with this game, and that was that. A lot more RPGs, which I paid for later on, I did a lot more and then I actually finished because that came out of pocket. That said, I tried out Final Fantasy 2 and 3 or 4 and 6, whatever. And which one starts? Is it 2 that starts on the ship or is that 5?
That's 4 that's... from the sound of it.
Yeah,
so that would
get...
be 2.
Yeah, okay. I remember playing that one and I don't think I got past the opening battle. I'm just saying, It didn't do anything for me, and I have always hated the RPGs with those, you know, tiny characters on the screens and stuff like that. I sound really awful towards the genre, but for the longest time, I just hated them for so many things. And I think a lot of them are really tough to get into, because it's really hard for them to kind of hit the ground running. And I think of the ones I played that had the best opening, and even that didn't keep my attention.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the series, and there's not a single game, like I would pick up and play any game in a heartbeat over another RPG series. I do have my favorites in the pack. I feel like some of them start off much stronger than others. The job-based ones for me are where things kind of slip. I'm not a big fan of Final Fantasy III or Final Fantasy V in comparison with the rest of the series, but both of the ones for the Super NES, I loved pretty much start to finish. My first game in general, the very first thing I ever played on the very first video game system I ever owned was Final Fantasy VI, which we would have known at the time as Final Fantasy III. And afterwards, I got to try Secret of Mana and Chrono Trigger because my brother was an RPG gamer before I had actually gotten into gaming. And I love the way that both games start off personally. But it's kind of different because the themes are really different, I guess.
I guess you said it was your first game. Like, did you beat it without some help, or did you have like a guide or magazines?
Oh no, I didn't beat it years later. I did not beat it 2 years later. I would run into the same problem. Here's the thing. I feel like when you're young and you're a video gamer, you're more likely to be a bit impetuous. And I certainly, as a child, was not the type to take things slowly and to work hard. So I didn't really understand the concept of the grind. And people have different views of grinding. Some people don't grinding. Some people hate grinding. The reality of the situation when it comes to RPGs is sometimes you have to grind. And I've come to enjoy it over time. But as a child, I would always push my characters to get through battles by the skin of their teeth. And then I would question why I wasn't able to beat a boss. So, no, the first time I played Final Fantasy VI and the first time I played Final Fantasy IV, I certainly was not able to beat them. But playing them since, the reason why I enjoy them as much as I do, even though they both are very, very different types of games, is that compared to other series that are RPGs, they're kind of cinematic, I feel. Like, there is kind of an operatic nature to the way that the narrative unfolds, and all these characters have so many quirks, and they're very dynamic in nature, and they have goals and backstories, and the plot events, usually there are twists and turns that I never see coming, so.
Okay, what about you, Daniel?
That was the bigger thing for me at the time. I felt like when I really started playing RPGs and video games in general, it was probably the best time for the genre.
I think the genre has gotten better with time, especially once they kind of realize like certain faults or shortcomings that it, you know, like you mentioned with Brian, and not everybody's a huge fan of it. Most RPGs still allow you to do it, but they kind of streamlined the process or made it less tedious.
I would disagree, kind of. I feel like the Western RPG genre has definitely gone better with time, but that the traditional JRPG genre has kind of become fixated to the cliches it was known for previously.
I guess part of it, and another reason why I wasn't a huge fan of RPGs back then, and this is a minor complaint, but I always hated random battles. Like, I enjoyed when RPGs kind of advanced to the point where you could see your enemies on the map and decide whether you wanted to engage in a battle or not, instead of just, like, walking around and having it randomly activate for you. I've tried other ones, and it's just really a pain in the ass to set up and record with. Oy vey. Okay. So we were asking Dan, have you played any of the Final Fantasy games from the... Final Fantasy 2 and 3, I guess, are the big ones.
Two and 3 being US 2 and 3?
Yeah.
Okay.
Stop calling them 2 and 3, Earl.
I mean, that was their names. If we're going to be fair to the Super NES era, those were the titles of the games, were they not?
Back in the day, they were. Nowadays, they're not.
Okay, so 4 and 6. If you want to be technical.
Yeah. If you want to just be what it is right now, really.
So have you played them?
Me?
Yeah.
I've played all of the Final Fantasies. I've beaten most of them up to 7. With the exception of 5, I've beaten all of the ones up to SNES era, I guess.
5 is a pain in the ass.
Yeah. 5 didn't really hook me at all.
I want to ask, but I want to hear your story first, because I'm really curious about 5 now, because it sounds like it's the jack sheep of that era.
Of the 16-bit era, it totally is. With the black sheep of the black sheep of the 8-bit era being Final Fantasy II, I guess. Final Fantasy V, like I said, is based on a job system, and it's a really in-depth job system, and it gives the game a lot of credit in that sense. The problem being, there's several problems, really. The first thing is that we have these characters, and we know more about these characters. They have more character than the characters that we saw in Final Fantasy III. Which were all pretty much blank slates. But the narrative itself isn't anything momentous. Like, in Final Fantasy IV, we have this huge sweeping narrative of redemption and brothers and dark versus light and evil versus good. And in Final Fantasy VI, we have the abuse of the environment and technology meeting magic and warfare and slavery. And there's all these complex themes going on in Final Fantasy IV and Final Fantasy VI. And Final Fantasy V is kind of a straightforward evil guy in the background destroys crystals to gain more power kind of deal. Now, part of that is because the main evil guy, Final Fantasy V, his name is X-Death, who is an evil tree. He's a very wah-ha-ha villain. Like, there's no complexity there. He's just evil. Like, that's the thing. Like, his motivation is wanting to have power and destroy things.
Yeah, he has less depth than Kefka even, and Kefka is pretty one-dimensional relative to other.
Kefka is wonderful from a nihilistic point of view.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Kefka as well, but he is still pretty, not one-dimensional, maybe two-dimensional.
Yeah, but one-dimensional for sure, X-Death, 100%. So part of it is that we don't really get to know our characters that well. They each have personality quirks, and that's made it pretty clear. But there's no progression with these characters. And there's no progression really narrative-wise outside of we have to go crystal to crystal to crystal to try and stop X-Death from blowing them up. And he always ends up blowing them up. They keep failing, you know? Now, there are some characters that stand out in the game. Gilgamesh, who was kind of an anti-villain, if I could use that term.
A new favorite term on this show.
My favorite term. And he's a fan favorite, I would argue, partially because the North American translation of the PS1 version of the game had a whole bunch of references to, like, Power Rangers and Mario. There's a whole bunch of weird pop culture references that were thrown into his dialogue. So the game has character and it has charm, don't get me wrong. It's not epic like the other ones, and it's fairly light on exploration. The bigger thing is just grind. It's a lot of grind. And the reason why is because, like Final Fantasy III, there's a whole bunch of classes, and then there's a freelancer position. But in this game, there's, I think, 30 or 40 classes, 30 or 40 jobs. And every time you master that job, you gain abilities. And the ability system is kind of like the shining point of the job system in this game, because, like, technically you can be a ninja with black mage abilities at the same time. So you can dual wield a weapon while throwing fireballs at people, which is cool. But you can't stay on any job for any amount of time because you master them and then the AP you collect at the end of each battle goes nowhere. So you have to keep moving from job to job. But if you keep moving from job to job, you're in this endless cycle of going from job to job just to gain some permanent stat bonuses and some permanent abilities for your freelancer class. So it requires a lot of work. The main problem for me, and I've beat the game three times now, and I think I only just fully gripped everything that happened when I just beat it a few weeks ago, actually, is that you spend so much time developing your party in battle and outside of the narrative that by the time you return to the narrative, you're like, where did I leave off? What the hell is going on? Kind of deal. So it's hard because that game, its story and its characters are not of the tier of Final Fantasy IV or Final Fantasy VI, but at the same time, the whole experience is kind of unbalanced. So that's why I feel like V is the hiccup moment for most gamers.
Okay.
I would have to tend to agree. The only thing I was kind of thinking of as you were kind of going on about V is that IV... and 6 both don't have a job system. They have a sort of class-based system that sort of mirrors a job system almost. 4 definitely not, but 6 does.
Each character has their own permanent class kind of deal.
Yeah, so like 4, basically everyone has the class and they gain new skills. 6 is they have less class-based things and more things related to them themselves. Like there's clearly a samurai character and he
yeah,
knows very similar.
Yeah, they're more valuable though.
Yes.
Their classes in Final Fantasy VI mostly determine what their limits will be, essentially.
Right. So both of those are class-based in the fact that they're pretty much set in stone. So you have a character attributed to the class, whereas in 5, you have a character, and he has definite development. Like, there's the 4 main characters, really, and they all have their own developments and stories and backgrounds and whatnot. But you can make them whatever you want. So it's a little bit of a half-breed of, like, you've got this characterization from 4 and 6, but you've also got this class-based system from 3. And 3's class-based system worked because they were all blank slates. You could just change them at will, and it was like, whatever, this guy's a scholar, now he's a dragoon, now he's a hunter. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Jack of all trades.
Yeah. One thing I will give a shout-out to Final Fantasy V for, in spite of the fact that we never really got it in its original release, it's the only Final Fantasy where the women on your party outnumber the men. So by the time you beat the game, there are some character switch-ups in your party that I'm not going to reveal for spoiler purposes, but by the time you actually beat the game, you'll have one person in your party who's a man and 3 women. So I always thought that that was kind of neat, you know, for the time at least.
Yeah, and then 6 goes on to have the main character, arguably the main character, be a female as well.
It's hard with 6 because it's such an ensemble piece, but yeah. I would argue that Hera or Locke are probably the main characters, yeah.
Getting off the Final Fantasy train for a bit. the other, I guess, big Square RPG of the era would have been Chrono Trigger, which is one of the most well-received, critically acclaimed RPGs of all time, actually. I know a lot of people, I remember growing up, because Chrono Trigger, and we'll get to Super Mario RPG in a bit, were super rare games. I remember I had friends in junior high school and high school who would pay upwards of, like, they were looking for $100-$150 just to own the cartridge of the game. I would say it's insanity, but people still pay that much for certain games from that era. But yeah, Chrono Trigger was also well known for its multiple endings.
Yeah.
And it's time travel, which I still hate as a concept for anything, but that's another discussion for another day. And another game I have tried like 4 different times and I can't get past.
See, I was just writing a feature on Final Fantasy 13 too, and how the time travel in that game made me want to kill myself. But I feel like the time travel in games like Chrono Trigger and Radiant Historia really got it right. Like, instead of having you pick from 30 different options of where to go, every time you do need to move back and forth through history or wherever you're going, it's a very straightforward process. Like, you pretty much know exactly which time period you got to go to and where you have to be, essentially. So I always kind of liked it in Chrono Trigger. There again, I've played the game 12 times, so it's hard for me to see it how like a newbie would. Or a newer player to it would, you know?
Well, okay. I guess how many endings is there officially in this game?
The amount of endings actually increased with the DS release, which I would argue, I don't know if the DS release is the exact same as the release for the iPhone, but the most recent release of the game is the most definitive version. There's a lot.
Yeah, I think there's 14 or so, somewhere around there.
So, have you seen them all? I mean, I imagine, like, after you beat...
I think I have, but to be fair, I think one day I just started YouTubing the endings.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, with this kind of era nowadays.
There was a time when, I don't know if either of you have played Chrono Cross for the PlayStation, but that was one of the first games that I got really, really hardcore into for the PlayStation. And I always... It's hard because... It's technically a successor to Chrono Trigger, but the bonds between the two games are fairly loose. Like, it's not a direct sequel by any stretch of the imagination. I think I played it, and I played it again after I beat Chrono Cross, just so I could try and tie together as many links between the two games as possible. And then I just got into a habit of playing it again and again, because it's fun. My biggest thing about that game is, like I said, I don't mind grinding, and I really love maxing out character stats and getting all of their attributes and abilities. So the ATB battle system in Chrono Trigger, for me, was the biggest hook. Like, I loved how I could enter a dungeon, and there wouldn't be a battle sequence that would initiate whenever an enemy comes up to me or whenever I've walked a certain amount of steps. I would just cross a bridge. There would be an enemy waiting for me, and then I'd enter a battle stance, and we'd start attacking each other. And that's the sort of ATB battle system that I don't think we really saw again until Final Fantasy XII, really.
Yeah.
Usually into action RPGs, and it is an action RPG. I mean, there's a planning element to the ring system where things can kind of slow down while you select actions, but for the most part, it is very action-oriented. And that was just the kind of game where my brother picked it up on a whim because he saw Squaresoft on the front of the box. He hadn't read any reviews. He hadn't seen any trailer. Well, this was at a time before the internet. The commercialization of the internet, at least. So, of course, he didn't see a trailer or any promotional material. So he just bought it on a whim, and we played the crap out of it. And to this day, I don't think that there's any game that makes me quite as happy just looking at it in terms of visuals and audio. Like, its aesthetics are just really appealing to me. It's so colorful, and everything, the whole experience is just enjoyable to me. I don't know if you've had the pleasure of playing Secret of Mana or not, Dan.
Only dipped my toes into it. I'm a big proponent of Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger, like you said earlier, but Secret of Mana, not so much, because it was more action-oriented, and so I didn't really, haven't had an opportunity to really get into it.
Now, am I remembering this correctly? Is this the one that, is this like one of the few that has like actual co-op gameplay for it, or am I thinking of something else? Like your friends...
What do you mean when you say actual gameplay?
Like, isn't it possible for like your friends to control different party members?
Well, yes, but that's more co-op.
That's what I meant.
There's co-op in Chrono Trigger too, though, isn't there? Wait. No, there isn't. What am I talking about? No. Anyway. Yes. And there's actually a multi-tap for Secret of Mana. So you could have both characters controlled by friends, providing you own the multi-tap.
That's a term I've heard in years.
And the weird thing about it is that, like, you can buy Secret of Mana from WiiWare, but I don't think that you can do multiplayer even if you have other controllers for your Wii, which is kind of lame. But I always felt like the experience was way funner if you had people playing with you, because the AI are dumb as shit. But I mean, you get by with the dumb AI. I mean, they can only screw up so many times, right? But it's always better with friends, that's for sure.
Every game's better with friends.
Or not every good. Game.
I won't ask. But yeah, that I remember trying that one out again because it was a game that, again, multiplayer in an RPG wasn't something that you heard of much of back then. Even now, you don't really, RPGs tend to be like a singular thing. I mean, we have the MMO RPGs, but that's a different beast. But yeah, I remember trying that out. And do you get like, a lot of these just kind of grew together for me. I really wish I'd spent more time on them. But I never wanted to force myself to actually enjoy the genre if I didn't. Secret of Mana. We also, I want to get this out of the way because I want to talk about it because I really hate this game, even though it's another franchise that I do love. Super Mario RPG.
Oh, no.
No,
because I love that game and the Super Mario RPG. Game.
You love Super Mario RPG.
Oh, so, I could talk for days about these games.
Well, you can open up the show with this one.
I kind of am interested in hearing what you have to say about Super Mario RPG, I guess, first, Earl.
I'm going to say what I understand what from my viewpoint it's petty and stuff. It's not a bad game by any stretch of the imagination, I guess. To me, it's always kind of felt like a Square Enix game with a Mario paint on it instead of a Mario game that had RPG elements, which is what I think Paper Mario and Adventure to Mario and Luigi games did much better, is that those felt like genuine Mario games that had RPG elements, where this just kind of felt like you could replace the main characters with anybody and it wouldn't change the game dynamic at all.
I think that's a fair point, actually. It's pretty much just, the main antagonist is unique to that game. Smithy is the main antagonist. He's just a giant Smithy who is...
A giant sword.
Yeah, basically. Well, so the sword, I forget what the sword's name is, but he's, like, guarding Bowser's castle. Basically, Smithy and his gang takes over Bowser's castle, and then he has a giant sword to protect it. You do eventually fight the sword, but then you fight Smithy, who's, like, the one creating all the minions.
Yeah, Smithy, in reality, is, like, four different things.
Yeah, he's, like, a shapeshifter thinger.
I don't know. Here's my thing. This was a game that I would continuously rent from Microplay. I don't know if you guys have Microplays. It'd be our video game rental and video game retail store that we had up here in Canada for a time. They're no longer around. And I would go every week, and I would always rent it and try and get further in the game because I think I was the only one touching that save file. Like it's the ideal like world where no one deletes your save file even though you continue to give it back to the retailer. I did eventually buy the game and I have it on the Wii as well, but the thing about the game to me is that at that point in time Mario and Peach and Bowser didn't have a lot of dimension. We didn't know a lot about their characters. We didn't really understand their motivations. It was always a very straightforward Bowser has stolen Peach, Mario goes after Bowser to get Peach back. That's all we kind of had to go on, right? This was a game that, for what it's worth, added some character to the Mushroom Kingdom, to the Toads, to Bowser, to Peach, to Mario. It added in some characters that I really dug as well. I still kind of wish that I could see Booster in a game. But because he really reminds me of Wario.
Yeah, he's like a Viking Wario.
Yeah, he is. And I think one of the pictures in Booster's Tower actually looks a surprisingly large amount like Wario, actually. So they may be related, who knows. But the thing is, at the time, we just didn't know a lot about the Mushroom Kingdom or the inhabitants of the Mushroom Kingdom. And the game kind of stepped in and made it kind of hilarious. Like, I love the game because it's entertaining. The dialogue is funny. The scenarios are funny. The gameplay itself, and I understand where both of you were coming on this, it's a traditional RPG. It's very much stop, select your actions, select an enemy, attack kind of deal. And I get that. But I think it's also fair to say that it was pretty custom tailored to the Mushroom Kingdom universe. I mean, Mario can jump or he can hit something with a hammer or he could shoot a shell at someone. Peach can attack someone with her umbrella. Bowser can throw a chomp rock. I mean, all their attributes and all of the enemies you face are informed by the Mario games themselves. So to me, it did feel like an extension of those Mario games.
Again, I feel like a lot of that stuff like, is cosmetic. Like, you can change it, and it could have been like anybody doing something, and it wouldn't have made a difference. I give this game a lot of respect because without it, like you said, it does start that trend that the Mario RPGs do pick up with Paper Mario, where they're funny, they're humorous, they expand the roles of the characters in this. You know, it's not just Mario saving the princess, especially in this game, because she's an ally throughout most of it. And the battle system, which becomes better developed later on, was introduced here with more active turn-based actions that eventually became the basis of Paper Mario and then Mario and Luigi. So out of that stuff, I do give the game credit for. I just feel like, you know, from an aesthetic standpoint, I didn't like the kind of like the, I guess, the shade figures. Like, they did that isometric 3D stuff. It's also another reason that I don't really care for Donkey Kong Country, but that's another story. And again, like out of the side characters just aren't. Well, I'm sure a lot of people love them, but they're not Mario characters, and they don't technically have a place in the Mario universe beyond this game, for better or worse. I know a lot of people. You said Boost. I know a lot of people love Geno.
Yeah. And
people always beg for a Geno game or whatever like that.
Well, he was going to have a cameo in a section of Superstar Saga, Mario and Luigi, but I think it was removed, along with all the other Nintendo character cameos.
Yeah, I think out of it had to do... I mean, one of the reasons we got Paper Mario was because of the falling out between Square and Nintendo. who knows what the future could have held for this franchise, because it, you know, like you said, it does introduce a lot of elements that do become staples in the franchise, a lot of the characterization. I think, you know, especially as a huge fan of Mario, I think a lot of the characterizations come from the RPGs more than they do from the actual Mario games, because you don't really have time to develop them when it's just like run and jump. That's it. I just could never get past that. Like, I think partially it's because I'm such a huge Mario fan. I could never get past, like, this doesn't feel like a Mario game to me. And that's always kind of held me back. And it's always been my least favorite. Though it's really close with Partners in Time right now. That's my least favorite Mario RPG game.
Oh, no. That's scary. Partners in Time gets a lot of flack for that.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to take a more of like a middle sort of ground here and say that I think that what Trent has to say is pretty worthwhile. It does feel like an extension at some points of the universe, because you kind of get Mario, at the time it was Princess Toadstool, Bowser, and then a few others. But then it kind of feels like the universe is expanded beyond them, and that's pretty cool. But to Earl's point, though, I think a lot of the antagonists, because they were never introduced and they've only appeared in that game as well, and they kind of didn't stylistically look, the whole game itself really stylistically didn't look typical Mario. I think the game sort of feels off in a way where it's like, yeah, this is still the Mario universe and you're still in all these Mario worlds, but the people you're fighting, like, there's no, oh, Bowser and Bowser's minions and all these guys are the Koopas. Whereas Paper Mario, you get Bowser as the main antagonist in the first Paper Mario, and all of the people you're fighting are like Koopas for the most part. You get some cool new enemies and some enemies that are exclusive to the Paper Mario universe, but they still kind of feel grounded in Mario, whereas Super Mario RPG's antagonists, at least, don't really feel so much, because some of them are stuff like they're knives or swords or stuff like that. They're a little bit more rough and tough than typical Mario characters you'd come to expect.
Yeah, and I mean, again, part of it is also just because this was really the time that Mario was kind of expanding out, and, you know, eventually when Mario spinoffs became the norm and not the exception. Like this, you know, Square Enix had an open book for it and they went for it. So I give them credit for that. I just felt like, you know, with the, because at this point we've had, what, 4 or 5 Mario games with the 3 on the NES and the 2 on the Super Nintendo. So there was enough to kind of work with, and they did their best. I mean, like, Luigi's doesn't even have a major role in this game. I mean, granted, he doesn't have a major role in the Paper Mario series, but he is around.
It's true.
He has some of the best roles in the Paper Mario series for not being a fable character.
That's true. He's honestly probably got some of the best lines in Thousand Year Door, which is my personal favorite game of all time.
Well, that's actually, yeah, I just replayed it. I love the Thousand Year Door. I feel like that was the peak of the Paper Mario series. And then after that, moving forward, that's when you start to switch to Mario and Luigi.
and I think the problem with the Paper Mario, and we'll probably curtail this real quickly, I think the problem with the Paper Mario franchise is, for better or worse, they're trying to do something different with it. And that's good, because everybody always says, you know, we don't want the same thing, we don't want the same thing. Until you do something different.
No, I want the same thing.
Yeah. I don't mind Super Paper Mario. I don't mind the 2.5 platformer, but yeah. That's not what I wanted, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And Sticker Star, that is not an RPG. That's resource allocation. That is a survival horror game.
I'm going to withdraw from Sticker Star, because Sticker Star honestly just gets me angry. Paper Mario is my favorite series of all time, and Sticker Star is honestly one of my least favorite games of all time. So within one series, you've got Thousand Year Door, which is my favorite, and Sticker Star, which is my least favorite.
It's just, I want to like Sticker Star so much. Like, every time I pick it up, I'm like, I want to like you, but I really, really hate it.
Yep.
I'm sorry, Intelligent Systems, you fucked it up.
I think Sticker Star, for what it is, I think if they had tried to advertise it as...
Okay, we gotta stop here. I hate when people say, for what it is.
Well, I was going to say, if they had advertised it as like an action, if they had advertised it as like an action puzzle, like it reminds me of kind of more old school point and click adventures where you're kind of solving some really abstract puzzles on the board with some sticker that you got like 10 hours ago. I think, you know, that part was kind of cool, even though some of them are really ridiculous. But I think
you sound like one of the apologists for for Banjo Kazooie Nuts and Bolts. For what it is.
That's a bad game.
No, you don't say for what it is. You say no. No, and then you whack Rare on the face and tell him never to do it again. You know?
I enjoyed Sticker Star. I thought it was a fun diversion. It has great music. I enjoyed the setup for it. I just think that, you know, kind of putting in the Paper Mario franchise and kind of making it seem like it was an RPG. Because a lot of the early choices did promote it. I mean, it has a turn-based battle system that just doesn't make any sense. You get no XP for it, so it makes no sense to actually engage in it. And yeah, most of the time I just ran through areas if I didn't have to, if I didn't need anything from them. The only thing, it's a really odd system because the only reason you engage in battles is to get stickers, and the only reason you get stickers is to engage in battles. So it's kind of like if you don't engage in battles, you don't need the stickers, so you don't need the battles. But
yeah, I'm actually going to take it a step further than what you said earlier and say that it would be a pretty solid game if it had not gone halfway on every system that it involved. Like you said, with the sticker system, you go into battles to get stickers so that you can go into battles more. Then why do you go to battles in the first place? It just feels like every system is kind of halfway done. The XP system is only done in every single battle that you win throughout the level amasses to a huge coin bonus at the end of the level. But the game also encourages you to go back to the main hub world and get more powerful stickers to solve puzzles. So when you're going through the level and fighting all these enemies to rack up your like end of level bonus coins and then leaving the level, that deletes all of your progress towards the final like extra coins you're going to get. So it's kind of like they're both counterintuitive to each other.
Systems that betray
each other.
I think the most egregious sin it does from a gameplay point of view is the boss battles. Because the general rules of play kind of take a shift. I don't know. The problem with Sticker Star in general for me is that it's expectations. I feel like when you set up a series and you continue to deliver a certain type of thing, like people are going to be pissed when you deviate. And I feel like there is some sort of legitimacy to people being upset. I mean, obviously you want people to be receptive to new experiences. But when the genre of the game kind of slips, that's when you really have to question where the direction is. If out of the blue, the next Legend of Zelda ended up being a first-person shooter, I'm sure most of us would not be tremendously thrilled. Right?
Very, very true.
You know? So the biggest problem, like, I was playing it, and I was thinking, like, there's no point to me going into battles, because then I just waste stickers.
Yeah, that was the
biggest problem. But I have to go to battles.
That was the biggest problem. It's like, if you fundamentally create a game where it makes no sense to engage in the gameplay, then that's a bad experience. And like you said, even the stickers you need for boss battles aren't stickers you get in actual battles throughout the level. And I thought you were going to say with the thing with the boss battles is, again, they're kind of puzzles and they're obtuse sometimes. Like, you need to go through a boss battle and fail before you can actually understand what the hell you need to do in some of them. Like,
that's the biggest no-no also. From a game design standpoint, trial and error, you want to avoid at any cost.
Yeah, I believe I think on the dock, you fight a giant octopus. And I didn't know, he has, this ink attack that KOs you in one hit or something like that. And you're supposed to use, like, a sponge to absorb it. Like, how the hell am I supposed to figure that out the first time? how are you even supposed to figure that out?
Yeah, especially when it seems like it's the next logical area you're supposed to go to as well. So it feels like, oh, there's this roadblock. I should be able to beat it. But nope, you don't beat it until later on.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. So, yes, like I said, it's not my favorite. It's my third favorite. I still prefer it over Super Paper Mario.
Oh, no. Earl, no.
Well, Super Paper Mario to me, and this is, again, going back to Trent's expectation, is Super Paper Mario is advertised, and we really need to end this conversation quickly. Super Paper Mario is advertised as a platform and RPG, and the problem was it was more platform with a lot more talking, and I don't mind RPGs where you kind of break up the action with talking and dialogue, but with a platformer,
it's kind of like an action RPG platformer.
Yeah, the thing is, it's more platformer than anything, and I think platformers kind of, like, I think platformers lose their fill if, like, every 5 minutes you're interrupted by a 10-minute cutscene or something like that. Granted, they weren't that bad, but, Yeah, that might be Super Paper Mario. But going back to Super Nintendo games,
yes.
Kind of started off with mentions of Breath of Fire 6 coming out on the iOS. So, Breath of Fire 1 and 2, any of you played that on the Super Nintendo?
I've played all the Breath of Fire games personally. There's some that are far better than others. But Breath of Fire, like the problems with the original Breath of Fire, I think the original Breath of Fire was actually published in some regions by Square, even though it was developed by Capcom. It came out at a time when all these competitors were all trying to release RPGs, not because they were popular over here, but because they were massively popular in Japan, and a few of them stuck over here. There was the Soul Blazer saga, there was a whole bunch of things being released by Square, there's a whole bunch of things being released by Enix at the time. Ubisoft wasn't really a player yet. Konami had a few. I don't know. I feel like every game developer was at least dabbling at that point. And Breath of Fire was one of the games that had a bit of a following, but I feel like it was more of a cult following at the time. Because it just didn't do things quite as well, I would argue. Those first two. Well, actually, two was fairly decent, but the first one in general wasn't mediocre. It was good. It was just competing with a lot of greats at the time.
Yeah, especially ones that were kind of more set in their ways. Because I mean, what Final Fantasy was on this third one. I think Dragon Quest was on its third one on the Super Nintendo as well. But yeah. I don't think I played Breath of Fire for some reason. I thought it was a beat 'em up. Go figure. I don't know. That was my genre thing, and you know, you had Streets of Rage and stuff like that. So, but yeah, I guess that's. I mean, is there anything else you want to say about Breath of Fire?
I honestly don't know very much about Breath of Fire, so that's why I didn't say very much. So I don't have very much to add at all, honestly.
And I guess
the structure of every game is pretty much the same.
You can finish on that. I was just going to wrap up. Well, not wrap up, but I figured the last major one we should touch on would be Earthbound, which is another cult classic.
Yeah, Earthbound, which is actually relevant today with the release of it on the Wii U.
Wii U Virtual Console, after some 20-odd years and people begging for it. So, Trent, have you played this one?
I have. I don't know. My opinion of Earthbound is going to be a little bit controversial, I think, because I'm not really a huge fan. I know it's a cult classic. I know a lot of Nintendo fans in particular cherish this series, the mother series. And more power to them. I just didn't really dig Earthbound. It was a grindtastic game. It was kind of a dungeon crawler more so than it was an RPG. There were some interesting plot twists, but overall, there was a whole lot of nothing. It was a lot of repetition. So I'm actually not the biggest proponent of Earthbound. I know that would rub a lot of people the wrong way, me saying that out loud. But I don't think it's a great RPG, personally.
I haven't played it yet. I do want to pick it up on the Wii U Virtual Console at some point. But from what I hear, from what a lot of people say, it seems like it's just to deal with the battle system and everything, and more to kind of do with its really obscure and offbeat sense of humor. And its, characters, like, it has its main characters are all little kids, and not, like, you know, Japanese, like, 17-year-olds who are, like, men and women and stuff like that. But these are actually, like, kids in a small town who just go on this super trippy adventure and fight the most randomest things in the world. So, yeah, that's what I've always gotten from people who are fans of this. And I think part of it, and, you know, I don't want to offend people, but I doubt anybody cares. But I also think part of it was because it was so rare that people kind of, like, built it up to be this mystical thing because, like, oh man, have you ever played Earthbound? It's amazing. Because, you know, like, you and, like, two other friends have played it before in your life, so you were part of this very special club.
That's probably true, too, actually.
Yeah,
it's like a rare gem among pretty much everybody until recently with the Wii U. And even now, with the Wii U not selling especially well yet, it's still kind of a rare gem to see people have played it.
Yeah. I mean, it's
going to sell well in the future, though, I think.
Yes.
I don't own one myself. I'm still kind of questioning where the system is going to go. However, considering the fact that sales rose in the UK about 700% right after the release of the Wind Waker HD re-release, and the fact that there's a Mario Kart and a Mario game looming on the horizon, I would argue that the sales are at least going to improve.
Very
but
true.
It can't get much worse. I will say this much. I think that's a discussion for another day. It's actually a discussion we're going to have next month, I believe, because we are planning a kind of big next-gen podcast, both here and on the other show. I figured ours would be a bit different since we're not we are gamers. The other one's more technical, breaking down this generation and stuff like that. This one's just going to be us nerding out about games and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, are there any other like big RPGs for the Super Nintendo that you wanted to hit on?
I just lost the list that we brought up before.
Well, why'd you look for that? We did get one.
But not especially. Shin Megami Tensei started on the Nintendo.
Did it? Well, I guess that that is a very special franchise.
I meant to actually say it didn't start on the Super Nintendo, but there are a few Super Nintendo games. And then afterwards, it kind of hopped onto PlayStation, sort of like what Square Enix did. It started on the original Nintendo system.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were an RPG fan on the Super Nintendo, once the N64 hit, you were kind of in the middle of the ocean with no raft. I mean, there were like two RPGs on the N64, like Quest 64, which I hear is awful, and I think that's about it, maybe.
Paper Mario.
Oh, Paper Mario, fine. We did get one request, or move more told to make sure we mention Mafia 2. So, there you go.
Oh,
Mafia 2 mentioned. I don't know what it is. Nope. Anybody?
Lufia 2?
There we go. That works too.
I think so. I've heard of it.
So here's the interesting thing about the Lufia games. And they're developed by Natsume, who you would most likely know more for the Harvest Moon games and the Rune Factory games. I've only played Lufia 2, the sequel, the Sinestrals. And I've heard from a whole bunch of people that the second game is better than the first. But the second game is actually a prequel to the first game. I think it takes place like... I'm not actually going to quote the time frame because I don't know how long it takes place before the first game, but a fair amount before. It's structured in terms of battle systems very similarly to a Dragon Quest, where you run into a monster or a set of monsters, and you see their pictures in front of you, and you see little tiny images of your characters in front as well. It's in terms of progression, its systems are fairly similar to Final Fantasy. The story is pretty interesting. I don't know. It's a neat game, and it was actually remade for the DS.
I think so.
Yeah, I think it was remade for the DS, but it was remade as an action RPG similar to one of the Mana titles. And it did not sell well as an action RPG similar to one of the Mana titles. But I've heard from a lot of people that they consider it to be a classic of the 16-bit era. So it's nice to see that it has some fan support even today.
Yeah. And I was going to say, if you were a fan of Super Nintendo era RPGs, the DS is a great system to have because a lot of those games got re-released and ported and remade on that system because... It sold very well in Japan, so why not put your money there and invest in these games? But yeah, I mean, those are like the major ones I can think of. And also, looking at this Wikipedia, it seems like a lot of them never made it over here, which is a shame. But like you said, RPGs weren't... RPGs didn't really kind of take off until like Final Fantasy VII and then the next generation, and then they became this huge ordeal. Because, I mean, Final Fantasy VII is the peak of the franchise, I believe. I think it sold something close to 8 million copies or something like that.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, it's insanely popular. since it's popular. And it, without the success of Final Fantasy VII, I don't think we would have seen a lot of these RPGs kind of get ported to the DS or re-released on the Wii Virtual Console, which, you know, a lot of these, I don't know if any of these are, most of these probably aren't available on the PlayStation Store, but I imagine a lot of these are available on the Wii Virtual Console. I know Chrono Trigger, the Final Fantasies, Super Mario RPG, I want to say Secret of Mana. So a lot of these games, if you want to check them out, if you haven't, are available on the Wii and the Wii U Virtual Console. I just also want to plug that in, because a lot of people seem to think that the Wii U Virtual Console is useless, but you still have access to everything that came out on the Wii. So that Virtual Console is still there for you, because people seem to ignore it if it's not part of the Wii U system for whatever reason. But yeah, check those out, and we will be back next week with, I don't know, I think next week might be our Halloween podcast, which I believe is going to talk about Resident Evil and Silent Hill movies, because I enjoy having Trent talk about the Silent Hill films. And he's not even here to defend himself.
No, I hate them so much.
Speaking of horror movies, check out the site. We have, I reviewed Curse of Chucky. I reviewed a very weird movie called Detention, which is a quote-unquote slasher, even though there's like two people who die in the entire film. Trent has Obsession 9, which I want to check out, which is on Netflix. Actually, all your movies are on Netflix. Obsession 9, and I think The Innkeepers?
Yep, and there's another one coming tomorrow.
No, it's on Netflix.
Whenever this podcast goes up.
This Friday, if you're listening to this Friday, we're doing Toxic Avenger as our 151-proof movie. Super excited for that. We have reviews of comic books up. We should have a couple of game reviews up. And check out the other podcast. Like I said, we're doing our Game of the Generation Countdown series, and this week we did top 7 most influential games of this generation, and that was quite a list. We have revealed some of them. I can kind of tell you this week. The bottom 3 are Angry Birds, League of Legends, and Minecraft, and already people are so upset about the fact that Angry Birds made the list, and Minecraft for some reason. But check that out. Find out what the other 5 are. Most of them probably won't surprise you. Some might not. Check that out. Last week we did top 7 new IPs and franchises. Again, another list that was kind of all over the place. Some picks I didn't care for, but, you know, it is what it is. So yeah, you can follow Trent on Twitter at InstaTrent. You can follow Dan at The Dan Affair. And you can follow me at Trent Hates My Name. And that is not my actual name, but it's ER_NOTR. Because I hate using my real name, and my initials worked out, and now I have business cards for it, so it defeats the purpose in changing it. So for Dan, Trent, and myself, this has been Nerds on the Rocks episode 148.